there will be no real non-controlled currency in the world.
It's DeFi's baby. We're coming for you, banks.
Increasing the block size to 32 megabytes right now. What would be the top five arguments that would get hurled against me?
No, that's a good one.
There are a few that the big blockers got right.
Ching, like all these coins splash into the wallets of all the winners. I love that.
There's a new threat out there. It's crypto.
Hello and welcome back to the Bitcoin Cash podcast, following Bitcoin Cash on its rise to global reserve currency. Today is Saturday, the 7th of September, 2024. This is episode number 127, Theft of Fire and Political Media, featuring Devin Erickson. Before, I'm your host, Jeremy. Jet is doing the producing, same as always. Before we get into the show, two quick little announcements. The podcast is still running its next Flipstarter campaign at fundme.cash. We've got 65% of the BCH we need, so still looking for a few more sats there to fund the next 10 episodes. If you're loving the show, you can go over there, try out the Wallet Connect and hit us with some sats. Would absolutely love that. And the second thing is our listener survey, which I mentioned on the last episode, is still running. We'll run it for another couple of weeks. You can go to bitcoincashpodcast.com/survey, S-U-R-V-E-Y, and in under 5 or 10 minutes, answer the 15 questions and contribute to the show's feedback when we read out all the announcements. I got to give a quick shout out as well to one of our listeners from last year's episode who said, in 12 months' time, BTC chain will have RBF on by default for all transactions. So making a completely accurate prediction apropos of absolutely nothing. Love to see that our listeners are on the ball there. All right. Our guest today is an author, an engineer, and a political writer. Devin, welcome to the show. How did you get into Bitcoin?
Well, I started out as a software engineer, and crypto was one of my specializations in terms of encrypting communications and keeping secrets and so on. So when this sort of blockchain, this shared spreadsheet that's verifiable and tamper-proof came along, and people started asking, okay, what can we use this for? Money seemed to be one of the obvious answers, because money is basically a measure of fucks given.
Yep. Absolutely.
You know, you've got a pile of stuff over here, and that's civilization. And you've got a pile of money over here, and that measures how much of a fuck people give about things. And you kind of use one as a medium to efficiently exchange the other. So I think money kind of started out as a spreadsheet. You know, you have a tribe of primitive hominids. They're keeping track mentally of who's contributed what. That's a spreadsheet. We only started tokenizing it with physical objects when tribes got too big for people to mentally keep track of. So now we've got computers. We're going back to the spreadsheet. So it seemed like a natural progression for me. And, you know, I also am writing this science fiction book at the time where it's like, okay, you know, you have a post-governmental society spread across cubic light hours of space. And so you don't have a central currency issuing authority. What are you going to do for a means of exchange? Well, cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, pretty now obvious. The book mentions Bitcoin and also a like Starlight kind of alternative. You clearly had a world in mind with sort of several competing currencies, though. Yeah. Well, it still wasn't like Bitcoin had just taken over and been everything, right? There were still localized alternatives.
Well, I'm a big believer in free market competition, and that includes competition between different protocols and different currencies. So in the universe of orbital Digital Space that I wrote, you know, Bitcoin is a major player. There are other cryptocurrencies, and, you know, certain large corporations are issuing their own scrip, and stock exchanges have largely been replaced with stock-backed cryptocurrencies, where you're using a blockchain model to keep track of who owns shares in stock. And I think that's something we might actually expect to see in the future, because this allows us to circumvent centralized stock exchanges.
Yeah, amazing.
And you would compete in sort of a money market, just as different currencies do today.
Yeah, it's a very kind of efficient, future-looking model. Actually, there's now that I think of it, there's not all that much trade that necessarily goes on actually within the book itself, right? It might be more coming in future episodes because it's so contained as
setting. This first episode is very, very tightly focused on the characters and the adventure they're having within this culture. So you get to see little glimpses through them of the society. But in the sequel, which I am about 78,000 words into of an expected 150 or so, you're going to see that very much open up, and you're going to get a tour of orbital space and see a little bit about the relations of the orbitals with Earth and see a little bit more of how that society runs. Because I had planned a lot of this stuff out, but right now it's the iceberg under the water.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. So your book is Theft of Fire, which is a sci-fi novel that's been released relatively recently, right? I'm not getting
last
that wrong.
November 11th. We've been out about 9 months.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Because I've been following it a bit on Twitter, but then I only read it just recently, and I didn't know that it was going to be part of a quadrilogy, right? So like you say, you've got it all planned out. This is a common theme among big sci-fi and fantasy writers, right?
Oh, yeah.
They shoot for the moon. They don't go small, right?
Yeah, well, you have to have a plan, because otherwise you end up as George Martin. And you certainly have to be able to demonstrate to readers that you have a plan and that you can deliver, because they are paranoid about you being the next George Martin. And frankly, George Martin's legacy will be that he killed a lot of careers, because really? What happens is people don't want to buy any of the series until it's all finished. And with your big epic fantasy stuff, you know, your 10, 7, 10, 12 volume stuff, that can take a decade. So who's willing to devote a decade of his life to something that isn't selling, you know? Yeah. So George Martin just about killed the epic fantasy genre. I mean, there's a few guys who got in before he slammed the door, you know, Brandon Sanderson and, you know, Larry Correa can get away with it because he started with urban fantasy and built up a big audience. But the new guys who are trying to come right out of the gate with the old school epic fantasy stuff, you know, there's a lot of good ones out there that you haven't heard of and probably never will, because their careers just die in the cradle.
This is crazy, because I've always had a theory, and I guess maybe it's not revolutionary or anything, that George R. R. Martin, you know, his success was kind of a bit self-defeating in that sense, right? Because he was grinding away, writing out these books, and then once it became this big popular TV series, suddenly he's living the high life. He's out there hanging out with the actors, having a whole great time, and that's just tanked his motivation to actually finish it. And you think, yeah, it's not going to come together like at all. Well, there's what, one or two books left, and it's just not gonna make it.
Hard to say. I don't think he's going to finish, and I have some theories on why, which I have written extensively about on Twitter, mostly having to do with his lack of character. But there is a challenge when your stuff takes off, and that is the challenge that I am facing right now, is when you write your first one, or when you write something that's like before you break out and become popular, no one expects of anything of you. You're writing in isolation and you're very able to focus on what you're doing. And then you get your first one out, it takes off, you have to focus on marketing, you have a lot of new demands on your time and attention, and then you have to revamp your writing process to work with that. So those first few months, I was kind of scrambling, playing catch up. How am I going to do this? And it took me a little while to figure out how to get back into the writing process. But, you know, when you become wildly successful like George is, you really have to have some commitment to it beyond your desire to pay the bills. And, you know, I think most authors have that. You know, if I wanted to get rich, I'd start a religion. You know, I wanted to like be a writer because I had a story to tell.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And I really enjoyed it. You know, I was thinking as I was reading it, it reminded me of, I don't know if you know Artemis Fowl. I read Artemis Fowl when I was a kid. It was kind of like had a more grown up vibe of that. And also Matthew Riley. I was a big Matthew Riley fan as a kid. I don't know if you ever read Temple or Ice Station, anything like that.
That one I don't know. Artemis Fowl I know.
Yeah. Anyway, it was more of these kind of adventure type of books. And I've got a quote here on the slide from you that you wrote saying, "Once upon a time, science fiction was about science and engineering, was about big ideas for how technology can transform the world, was about what a high-tech future might look like and how it might feel to be a real person living there, was about our hopes and aspirations. But something happened. Somewhere along the way, our fiction lost hope, began preaching our inevitable failure, began sifting through the ashes of endless visions of decay, began lamenting instead of inspiring, began above all lecturing us for daring to have hopes, dreams, and desires, for daring to think that the universe is a better place with humans in it than without, that tomorrow might be better than today. While some of us aren't interested in self-flagellation and we're not done with the big ideas yet." And when I read that as part of researching the book, before I actually read the book, I thought, wow, this is a real mission-driven thing. Like you said, it's clear that you have kind of a whole movement, I guess, maybe, that you're trying to start. It's not just I had a story, you know, a one-off book that I wanted to write, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in the latter part of the 20th century. You know, first of all, I was the son of one of the lead engineers on the Voyager spacecraft. So I was that kid hanging out at all the at all the Voyager press conferences, watching live as the pictures of the outer planets came up for the first time. And that was exciting. And, you know, the science fiction of that era was all about what are we going to invent? And how is it going to change our world? And what is humanity going to do? And I think gradually some of the larger publishing houses in Manhattan got infiltrated by a certain kind of person who they weren't really very interested in what people wanted to read. They were a lot more interested in what they thought people should read. And they were very interested in sort of scolding people for, you know, conquering the world and using energy and having population growth and basically all of these pro-humanity ideas. They were sort of socialist or communist anti-humanity types. And, you know, they wanted to write about the inevitable collapse of civilization, or they wanted to publish stuff, I should say, about the inevitable collapse of civilization and, you know, how we're all going to be fighting off the radioactive zombies with a sharpened piece of rebar, or living in grass huts with solar panels on the roof. Now, I like a good post-apocalyptic Mad Max fighting off the zombies with rebar story as much as the next guy. I mean, that can be some fun adventure stuff. But when it squeezes out all of the classic science fiction about exploring the universe and discovering new things and adventuring on a new frontier, then maybe that's gone a little too far. So I wanted to write in that paradigm, you know, with the only thing that's updated for modern audiences being the actual technology. And I wanted to prove thereby that people are still interested in reading this kind of story.
And yeah, and I think they have been, right?
Based like on the reception.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's standing out in a crowd, right? If everybody is too scared to say something and you're the one person who's prepared to get out there and be like, no, I'm unapologetic about this kind of thing, then that's going to make waves, right?
Yeah, we're done with galactic empires being just backgrounds for characters to have heartfelt discussions about pronouns over tea. We want science again. We want engineering again. We want exploration again. We want adventure again.
Yeah, no, it's incredible. This is obviously this is very reminiscent of the Bitcoin Cash community, and this podcast is in the same position of having been like shut out from the main narrative that everybody was supposed to accept, right? And the, all the history of what happened, right?
Yeah, the future changes. The shape of the future is driven by people who are more excited about what could be than afraid.
That's a good quote. That's a good way to be. Yeah, more excited. Well, you have to be progressive, right? You have to, this is this whole sort of e-acceleration type of vibe that's going on at the moment, right? Which is you just have to build faster than you can be regulated, or you have to grow faster than you can be censored or capped off, right? And that's the same theory, I think, the same theme that comes through in the book.
Or you can leave the gravity well.
Escape, find a new frontier, right? If you're not being, go where you're being treated best, right?
Libertarian societies have always thrived on the frontier, because when you have a bunch of people who are filtered for quality, they don't need much governance. They pretty much behave themselves and do what they need to do and build cool stuff, and you don't need to manage them. But you need that filter function. And for early America, that filter function was the Atlantic Ocean and the wilderness on the other side. You know, if you didn't have your shit together, you didn't make it there. And if you were the sort of people who couldn't play nice with others, you didn't survive there. So automatically, you had a society of pretty high quality people. And they were prepared to cooperate and get along and work things out for themselves. So, you know, they didn't need a lot of minding. They didn't want a lot of minding. They made themselves a government that didn't want a lot of minding. So now some of those filter functions are no longer as effective. And even here in America, although certainly less so than in other places in the world, like, say, Australia, to pick one at random.
Yes.
Even here in America, we have a lot of busybodies now who are more concerned about threats than they are about possibilities. And they're more excited about regulating something than they are about building something. And those people are just speed bumps between humanity and its best possible future.
Yeah, and I mean, this is no shocker to either the BCH or crypto communities generally, I'd say, who have been, you know, decried as these rebellious, you know, dangerous, blah, blah, blah people. And then slowly as society catches up, instead of saying, wait, you guys are right, maybe we should listen and learn from you, instead, the people who didn't get it at the start show up and say, now we should be the ones in charge. We should be the ones writing the regulations. We should be the ones keeping everyone safe. We're the ones who know what's best for this technology, even though they came along you know, after spending a decade saying it was not going to work and it was all going to fail and everyone involved was an idiot, right? So how do you stop that cycle happening of the section of society that wants to just grab control, but only once it's relevant, from getting its claws in?
Well, this has to do with how much these people get listened to. So what we need to do is start holding them in contempt and spread contempt for them, because the verdict of history is already in. Libertarianism works. Capitalism works. Every time we try these things, we build massive wealth and technology. And then because we've built massive wealth and technology, it attracts these parasitical types who want to latch onto that because they can't build anything themselves. You know, your communists, your democratic socialists, your collectivists who come along and say, where's my share? Or this thing needs to be collectively and responsibly controlled. And we need to understand this notion that civilization and private property go together, because civilization is a whole mound of stuff that people created by investing effort in raw materials drawn from the environment. So you only have civilization if the people get to keep what they invest in. No one will invest in anything or build anything if it's going to be taken away by others in the name of the collective. And once we understand that, we can start sort of getting people to ignore these purely theoretical arguments about fairness, which are basically just a whine, and focus on the fact that, you know, when you build something, the person who knows how to build it, the person who knows how it works, and the person who knows how to make sure it keeps working is the person who built it in the first place, because they're the ones who are drilled down on all that technical knowledge. So, you know, we need to win this argument. We need to win this argument, or humanity stays on the same planet until the next asteroid comes along or the sun goes nova and obliterates us. This is literally about the survival of the species. And we need to learn to hold non-productive, stupid people in contempt. People who don't make anything but arguments about how they should be allowed to take other people's stuff.
Yeah, I completely agree, right? I'm on Twitter out there mocking and bashing people on the Bitcoin subject regularly, and I don't do it with great enjoyment. I don't just do it because I'm an asshole or something like that, but because for a lot of people, the only way that I'm able to get through to them that maybe there's a different point of view they need to consider, if I just, you know, try and rationally talk to them, they just come back with laughing GIFs or something like that. You know, it's like the only way to communicate with some people is at that level of just childhood, like, drama or something like that. And so that's the tools we have to use, right? There's no other option. What do you say to people who say, well, you should take the high road, you know, you should show by example a better way rather than getting, you know, you fight with a pig and you both get dirty kind of idea, right?
Well, empirically, that doesn't work. A pig does not need your permission to wrestle you. It can just tackle you. Your choice when the pig tackles you and you are in the mud is either to lie there in the mud face down saying, I have principles, or to fight back. You know, it may take two to tango, but it only takes one to start a fight. And these kinds of discussions are a fight over the future of civilization. And it's a fight between pro and anti-human. And it really is that simple. And the thing to remember is that any kind of debate, the target is not the other person. You're not going to convince them. They are emotionally invested in their position. The target is the audience. And the goal, therefore, is to show how foolish the case against you is. And, you know, we have a big advantage here because, you know, we actually know things and we can actually build things. So the anti-civilization forces, the collectivists, the statists, the socialists, and so forth, you know, the regulators, the takers, the non-producers, you know, what their only skill is wordsmithing. Their only skill is making these creative arguments, making these highly convoluted, and of course, you know, trying to control media sources to shut us out of the dialogue. So ultimately, we're the ones who can point empirically to the data. We can listen to Europeans natter on all day about how their system is better, but then we can point to the performance stats. Well, America invented everything. You know, you those guys are orbiting their satellites with our rockets.
Yeah, and not the government ones either. You know, there's been that whole thing where they're going to need the, what's it called, Dragon capsule to rescue the guys on the space station.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know,
and I think all this stuff that you're talking about is things that you've been very vocal about on Twitter, and I found it fascinating as a marketing strategy for the book, right? Because this is not like long form Twitter posts are themselves a bit of a sub niche, and the interest in these political ideas is also a niche, and then science fiction is also a niche, and you're doing a fantastic job of having an individualized vibe by combining all of these different elements together. How was it that you found this was the right way to get traction on the message? Because it's very unique.
Okay, well, this came from one piece of understanding, and that is, as an author, my job isn't to sell books. That's not what I do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. My job is to build a relationship with an audience. And, you know, obviously the books are part of that because the books are a big part of what people are there for. But the goal is that you have an audience of people who are interested in what you have to say, and they know that they're interested because you've always produced in the past. And that is how an author becomes financially successful and well-known and so forth. It's about building that audience relationship. So what you want to do is you want to speak honestly to that audience about who you are and what you have to offer. And you want to show them, not tell them. So all of those Twitter long form posts are just my reactions to things. They're just living examples of how I think and how I see the universe. It's completely honest. There's no real calculation in it. I don't sit down and say, well, maybe if I wrote a post about this, I'd sell some books. Because if I had gone that route, I wouldn't have done nearly as well. You know, one of the big things that made me take off is that there was this tech CEO who was very naive outside of his specialist field, who suggested that society would be improved with a 100% inheritance tax. Yeah. The idea being everybody starts on an equal footing. And of course, this is one of the more terrible ideas in the history of terrible ideas, because this wipes out all your family businesses and all your generational wealth building and all your generational knowledge. And it filters all wealth every generation through the government, which has sticky fingers. And so, you know, this does wreaks incalculable damage. And so I went off on him. And the funny thing is, this particular individual had been one of my ARC readers. advanced reader copy people who do reviews, and he had said some very kind things about the book. And if I had been all about my career success, I would have been, well, you know, this guy was saying nice things about me. I better stay away from him. But no, this was a natural reaction. You did a communism. You know, bad CEO, don't do a communism. And that really resonated with people because it was honest and because it spoke to anxieties that they had. And, you know, I woke up with 20 times the followers I went to bed with on the previous evening, and I discovered that I'd sold about 450 books online that day just from people saying, I like the way this guy thinks. Maybe he can write fiction as well. So you're showing people how you think. You're showing people that you can write. You're showing people that you care about what they care about. And all of that builds sort of a friendship with your audience. I mean, obviously you can't hang out with all of them and have dinner, but you can have a certain amount of dialogue with them, and you can build that relationship of trust. And so that's what all of the marketing stuff is ultimately aimed at, is showing people who I am and what I do and what I provide so that the people who like that can find me.
Yeah, and it's been really successful. Like, I had seen several of your posts and read them. That's just the way that the algorithm is. And it's funny, it takes kind of repeated exposure before somebody will click, even if they are on the right wavelength, mm-hmm. let alone if they're not. But if they're on the right wavelength, they still need to see something three or four times. So it's about this kind of persistent delivery, which builds up until you just hit a critical mass tipping yeah. point. And that, it's a fascinating example you have there of doing something that maybe, you know, if you had a PR firm managing you, would have said, don't do this, right? But it's that authenticity which yeah. cut through the noise.
Yeah, PR firms, they think in terms of attention, and I think in terms of trust. And that's why it takes multiple exposures to get someone to patronize me by buying the book or by subscribing on Substack or, you know, contributing to my Kickstarter or all these different revenue streams I have. It takes repeated exposures because trust isn't built in a single encounter. No matter how much someone approves of what you do in one encounter, they're not going to trust you just based on that, because that's not how the human brain works. You have to be able to be consistent. They have to see repeatedly that you are consistently not George Martin, that you are keeping your promises and not betraying their trust. And that's especially true for people who read science fiction and fantasy, or any kind of book, really, because the experience of reading a book and enjoying it is so personal and so intimate. You know, when you're curled up on the couch reading, that is a whole other universe that maybe other people are reading it elsewhere, but you feel like it's happening just for you. So it's a very personal kind of experience. And so you're letting the author into your brain, and being let down in that kind of experience can be extremely disappointing. So it takes time to build that trust, but when you build it, you get people who are very enthusiastic about your work. And, you know, some of them have absolutely embarrassed me with their interest in my career and their help promoting it and their generosity. I mean, some of you guys out there are nuts, and you're great and you're awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, got to give a quick shout out to Bitcoin Cash yeah. Ortis, who is one of your loyal and dedicated followers, who clearly appreciates a lot of what you do enough to have mentioned it several times to line up this show to happen, and has even created some NFTs for Theft of Fire that you can get right now on TapSwap. We have a QR code here. The idea being that what he did was he read your book, which he pirated because he's a big guy that's against sort of intellectual property, and he's more like let the open world be open source kind of a vibe. And then he pirated it, but then he donated you one Bitcoin Cash in sort of payment for that, despite having pirated it rather than going through any regular mechanism. And he's now bringing that to everyone else with the same opportunity that you can buy one of these NFTs and then they can either pirate a copy of their own accord, or they can get in contact with you with that NFT to get a full like copy of the book that way, rather than going through a traditional publisher and stuff. So it's just like innovation happening at the level of those fanatical supporters, right?
Yeah. And I love this story because it informs my attitude about piracy and copying stuff and what we call intellectual property. And because, you know, a lot of people who produce ideas, who our job is to create ideas, you know, they have a very fraught relationship with the idea of copying, because you get this sort of little problem that crops up. You know, we call it intellectual property, but it's not just that. It's anything where you have a high fixed cost and a low per unit cost. You know, it's like the pharmaceutical development works the same way. You know, you can synthesize these drugs really cheaply, but researching them takes millions and billions of dollars. So you have this problem that then when you produce it, people say, well, it doesn't cost you anything to give me a copy. Why should I pay you? And then the other side of the argument is, I have to defray my fixed costs somehow. You know, we spent hundreds of millions researching this drug, or I spent a year of my life writing this book. So that's kind of the argument as it stands. So, you know, I could have gone down this road of, you know, all you people on the pirate sites are stealing from me. And that would have led nowhere. Instead,
well, probably more piracy. They would do it to piss you off. Probably.
Instead, my model is, I'm not selling books, I'm developing a relationship with an audience. So the people who pirate it, maybe they're going to end up supporting me in other ways. I fully accept that all of the financial support I receive from people online is voluntary, and most people are pro-social, so that works just fine.
Yeah, it's really interesting because the Bitcoin Cash community is in this same situation that you are in, of having like a small but very, very overwhelmingly passionate, ideologically driven, motivated people who've been through a lot and have stuck, you know, with the project despite all this sabotage and all this stuff throughout all the whole history of Bitcoin, right? But they're having trouble at times, like breaking through, because there's so much other noise out there, right? In the same way that you're trying to create a readership in an industry where there's just already bigger publishers, there's already more books being produced by more famous authors and whatever. So you need to find a concentrated niche and attack it like you've been describing. I'm wondering if you have any other tips in that regard, because I think it's something the Bitcoin Cash community could really benefit from.
Oh yeah. The way to get around these kinds of roadblocks is to think differently. I was told, you know, you have to find a publisher. I was like, no, I don't want to find a publisher. I want to retain control basically over my intellectual property. Or, you know, you can't sell books on Twitter. You have to get to the reviewers on TikTok. Well, no, I don't want to do that. I'm just going to get on Twitter and say what I have to say. And so sometimes the road less traveled leads around the common obstacles. And, you know, so sometimes we need to think about things in a new way, because often when we get stuck, It's because we're thinking about things in the wrong way. It's because we're using the wrong labels for things. And this is kind of where I want to talk about this idea of intellectual property. You know, just to give you an example of this kind of different thinking, well, we've spent 25 years in Western civilization wasting our time having a stupid argument because somebody used the wrong word. Somebody said privilege when they meant opportunity. So we've had a 25-year argument about privilege when what we were really talking about is opportunities. Some people have privilege. You have white privilege. You know, you have this privilege. You have that privilege. No, that's fatuous, blah, 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 blah. But really what they're talking about is opportunities. Hey, you are wealthy because you had opportunities. Why, yes. There's no argument. But when you call them opportunity, when you call them privileges, people want to take them away. When you call them opportunities, people want to give them to more people. So the term you use can change how you think about a problem. So in the crypto community, in the libertarian community, we have this big argument about intellectual property. And property is a word that we made up way back when the only kind of property was physical. And that word carries all that baggage of physical property with it. So you have this argument between people who say, well, ideas exist in a sort of idea space, and you can't homestead the noosphere. You can't, you know, claim that you own a particular prime number. That's ridiculous because the numbers already exist. And then on the other side of that argument, you get the people who say, for example, have written a book, and they're like, so my book already existed? Is that what you're saying? But I did some work to produce this book. And if people want other people to do that work, there has to be somehow that I get paid. So those are the two sides of this argument. And that argument has been fostered by this selection of the word property. Well, I don't think property is the right word. I think investment is the right word, because civilization is based on investment. We take things from the material universe, bunch of rocks, we invest effort in them, melt them down and extract the metal, and we build things with the metal by investing more effort. And then civilization becomes more complex, and we invest money. We have tokens of investment, but property is really investment. The reason that we want to control property is we invested in it. We expect a return on our investment. We expect to control our investment. So we can argue all day about whether ideas already exist or we create them, about whether information wants to be free or not. But at the end of the day, what we're talking about is not intellectual property, but intellectual investment. So the question is not who owns the idea. The question is, how do we reward someone who invests in an idea in a way that is valuable to us? And then the answer becomes more clear. It's not about my right to extract $10 from everyone who gets a copy of my property. It's about how do I get a return on my investment of a year of my life in creating this story that people enjoy. So my strategy is this patronage model. Get people enthusiastic and they'll want to pay you. So instead of picking a fight with these pirate sites, I said, okay, well, this is one of these little seeds that I'm planting. And you know, maybe this one pays off, maybe it doesn't, but I have other seeds that I'm planting. And so long as my garden grows, so long as I get rewarded, then other people will try to follow in my footsteps and try to do what I did and get rewarded the same way, and there will be more good books to read.
Damn, I'm loving this, because this idea of investing strikes me a lot as the BCH community has for many years, you know, and following on since the initial civil war and stuff, been at war with the BTC community over the Bitcoin branding and trying to convert people, use our technology, use your technology, what, you know, one version of Bitcoin is better or worse than the other, and all this sort of stuff. And because the BCH community came off worst in the initial confrontation, all the snowball effect that's happened since then, as well as the censorship regime and all this stuff that was done to keep it under wraps, the BCH community for many years was quite ineffective at finding a way around that. But I like what you're saying about investing. If the community is more in a, like, let's say if I wanted to spread, you know, BCH in my local community, instead of trying to go into all this detail with everyone or try to have some big intellectual argument about it, whether it's face to face or online, if instead I visualize it as I'm trying to invest in it and also give other people reasons to invest in the community too. So you have to bring something that is going to, aside from any arguing and debate, give them a immediate return on investment, even if that's just emotional, even if it's just fun or engaging, or I guess it could be, you know, resource based too, but then you run out of resources pretty quick, right? So you're looking for things that are cheap to reproduce, like an emotional experience, like you said, with the book reaching so many different people who then recommend it to their friends, right?
Yeah, I think you've grasped the basic idea. This war, civil war that you describe between BCH and BTC sounds like a turf war. It sounds the result of people thinking of this space, this crypto space, as property that they are going to fight over. When the real question is, how do we reward the people who invest in these new technologies in proportion to how useful those technologies actually are? I've always been a little bit frustrated by the crypto wars, where people are arguing online, and, you know, because I was a software engineer, and, you know, my way of looking at it was always argue with code, you know. Yes. Your code is your argument. Does your code work? And I would like to see less sort of arguing online and more production of, okay, here's a concrete result that people will invest in, and instead of having a shouting match, let's let the market determine the winners. And the way I wrote it in the book, there's not one winner. There's many winners, because the economy is not a zero-sum game. It's creating more value all the time. And whether BTC or BCH or XYZ or PDQ or whatever captures more of that value, in the sense that this token represents this much of the economy, this much of all the stuff there is, there's still an ever expanding amount of value out there to be captured. You know, if one of these acronyms captures 10% of the market, of the total value of human stuff, and another one captures 20% and represents 20% of the value of the economy, who cares? Who really actually cares? Because what you've both done is create a useful means of exchange. And there's never going to be one winner, because people are always going to be trying things. people are always going to be trying new approaches to building with this basic technology. I mean, you've got Dogecoin, for heaven's sake, you know, because people thought it would be funny. And real fortunes have been made off this. So instead of getting in the kitchen and fighting over your slice, maybe it makes more sense to focus on what you're doing to increase the size of the pie.
Yes, yes, I love this. And what do you think about in the book, you're sort of playing with these ideas about, yeah, like you said, frontier society, which is less governed and perhaps, you know, an offshoot at one time. Obviously, the societies were, you know, everybody was all on planet Earth, but then some people are in the belters and they kind of developed in a different direction, and some people have kind of stuck with what they already knew and so forth. So it's the same as that cultural split over time in Bitcoin. For the ones who are the more progressive is kind of the wrong word, because that's been reused in so many senses that it's kind of lost a lot of its original meaning, right? But if you're the more frontier-based community, which is how I would describe BTH relative to BTC, what is the winning strategy besides just having left whoever you left behind when you left them, right? That's a start, but that's not enough.
Mm. Well, you're not trying to win. It's winning is a term that we take from zero sum games.
Yes.
You know, if you're playing chess, you're playing it for a limited time, and there is one winner and everyone else is a loser. You know, Monopoly, whatever, Risk. But the economy is not a board game. The economy goes on forever. There are not a limited number of players. So your goal isn't to defeat all the other players. It's to stay in the game and continue growing. So when you have a population that is more audacious and more adventurous and makes more change, which is how you describe your community, and here I'll take your word for it, we'll proceed on that premise, you know, then you are the higher risk, maybe higher reward investment providing growth, while the lower risk investment provides stability. You know, This is why we have a lot of different investments in society. Capitalism is essentially a system, and in combination with libertarianism, is essentially a system for implementing massive parallel processing within society. Because everybody does their own thing, most of them fail, but then we all imitate the winners. So the fact that there are all these splinter groups and branches and different cryptocurrencies, that's not a bug. That's a feature. We have so many people trying different things, and we don't know what's going to be good or important until we try it. I mean, we have all these intellectualized arguments about technical aspects of various different implementations of the blockchain, and I'm not going to go on about that, because despite the fact that crypto is my area of expertise in programming, I'm not drilled down on this particular corner of it. So if I pontificated, I'd only sound stupid. So we have all these technical arguments about what is best, but really we don't usually know what it is that the market really needs. And the ultimate argument is empiricism. You create your thing, you put it out in the world, and you see if it works and produces value.
So if you had to guess, let's say we've got all the different cryptocurrencies at the moment, and I'd say on average, the entire crypto, like, it is working as a revolution. It's going to win. It's going to destroy fiat currencies in the long run. But in the short term, people maybe were a bit overexcited about how quickly it would get adoption and everybody would be paying for cryptocurrency with everything, you know, by next week, right? So Where do you think the disconnect has been so far? Is it just the case that a new technology always needs time to find its footing? Is it nobody's hit on the right formula yet? Is it something specifically that's lacking in the marketing or the promotion? Where's the blockage point right now for people, the average people, just mass adopting cryptocurrencies, in your view?
Several things. First of all, ease of use. And like with any social network, because money is a social network, when you're trying to start one, you always have a chicken and egg problem. You need audience to get audience. You know, I can carry around all this cryptocurrency stuff. I can have the little app on my phone, but if I can't buy an Apple with it, it's not much good to me. If I can't buy my groceries with it, it's not much good to me. And if you are a grocer who sells apples, then you're only going to start accepting cryptocurrency when enough people are really demanding this. So, chicken, egg. And this doesn't mean that new technologies don't get adapted. It means that they get adopted slowly. And I always knew from the beginning that this was going to be a very slow process. This is going to take more than our lifetimes. Accept that. Accept it. Just because you are excited doesn't mean that 7 billion people don't have a lot of momentum. What you can do is build and promote the technologies that will eventually win. But let's face it, if you're in this community and you're super enthusiastic, it's because you are super technical. It's because you are excited about the possibilities and tolerant of the risk. And not everyone is like that. Most people have a whole bunch of stuff going on in their lives, and they don't have the bandwidth for another project. They need something that is going to be a trustworthy drop-in relationship for cash. And building trust, as we mentioned before, requires repeated exposure. So the fact that a lot of people are getting fantastically rich off cryptocurrency is a trust builder, but it's not going to be enough by itself. You have to achieve penetration to, you know, think about it. What you want is the largest of all audiences. Your ask that you just articulated to me is you asked for 7 billion subscribers, right?
Yep.
So, you know, that's a big ask. You know, you have a streaming podcast that we're doing right now. How tough was it to start getting subscribers? It's a long, slow process, right? Even when you have a quality product, which clearly you do.
Thank you.
In my completely unbiased opinion. Well, you invite the right guests.
Yeah, that's right. It's all the guests. It's all the guests after all.
So
guest selection is all we
do. Yeah. So this is a gradual process of building all of humanity as an audience. And I think that the crypto community just has to accept that. It doesn't upset me. It doesn't scare me. Because in the same way I'm writing about, we're going to colonize the solar system. Well, that's going to take some time, too. We're going to unlock the human genome and start to modify ourselves. Well, that's going to take some time, too. We are going to create sentient AI and new forms of life. And that's going to take some time, too. Just because the road is long doesn't mean it's not worth walking on. So don't be impatient. You can't be impatient. You're going to be disappointed if you're impatient. Because one of the things, and this is my second reason that has to happen, is that the value has to stabilize. I mean, it's a big party when you buy Bitcoin at $100 and it goes up to $64,000. That's nice. That's fun. We like seeing those big numbers in our accounts go up. But when people who are not seeing it as an investment, but as a means of exchange, which is what it's eventually supposed to be. When they see that, it means that it can also go down. So they don't want to necessarily put all their money there, because bad as the dollar is when it is compared to cryptocurrency, they know that there are powerful entities with lots of men with machine guns, which will not allow the dollar to collapse utterly. So there's a consideration of risk there. And eventually the value against other things of cryptocurrency is going to have to stabilize and become predictable for it to be useful as a means of exchange. Now, this doesn't mean that currency is never a good investment. I mean, basically, you have a supply of stuff, which is civilization, and you have a supply of money. And the stuff that is civilization is growing all the time. So if the supply of money grows more quickly, like if you have some criminals running the United States government who just print the stuff, then prices go up, and we call this inflation. Gradually, your currency loses value. And if the money supply increases at the same rate as the supply of stuff, then prices stay very stable. And that's nice. This allows us to do all kinds of financial forecasting that we couldn't before, including on our own personal budgets. How much money will I need to retire? Well, now I know, because eggs will cost the same in 10 years until somebody produces, you know, and like a genetically engineered eggplant, and suddenly they're cheaper. But if you have a fixed supply currency where you can't make any more and the amount of stuff keeps going up, then you have deflation, which is something that we have not seen in history. And it sounds very nice because, oh, you mean if I just sit on my account and don't invest it anywhere or do anything with it, it still gains in value? Oh, that's nice. But then maybe there's some worries that people won't go and actively invest in new enterprises, which, of course, drives the supply side of the economy and is important for new technology and stuff. So we're in unexplored territory here, and we need to take the time to not just to figure out what we're doing, but to see empirically what works and what doesn't. So, yeah, the value has to become a little more predictable before Bitcoin becomes or Bitcoin Cash or a Dogecoin or any of these other coins becomes a means of exchange, which is what most people use dollars for, rather than an investment.
All right, let me hit you with the counter argument to this, which is that Bitcoin's fastest growth ever as a medium of exchange in its early days was when it was the most volatile, because volatility on the way up is people getting rich, like you said, which drives actually massive adoption. And the stats are that as the price rockets up, people get a wealth effect where they actually become more willing to spend their cryptocurrency than to hoard it. Now, of course, you pay for that on the downside, because when the price goes down, then everybody feels terrible and they sell it, or they stop using it, or they think, you know, why did I get into this, right? But as more people adopt something at a faster and faster rate, if you have a growing exponential rate of adoption, that is of necessity going to create enormous volatility, because so many people are entering and leaving the system at an increasing rate. So my theory is that Bitcoin will, or all cryptocurrencies, Bitcoin Cash, will get more and more and more volatile actually over time as the adoption rate kicks in, until you're past, you know, the 80% of saturation. The population.
Yeah,
you hit saturation, and then the volatility will like taper off at more relative to the global economy. But that's only once you hit that saturation. In the meantime, the process of adoption is going to be very volatile. And while you can create substitutes or workarounds, people should not be expecting
for cryptocurrency to get volatile and then get adopted, it will be volatile in being adopted and then get stable. That's my point of view.
Yeah. Adoption drives volatility. Volatility does not necessarily drive adoption.
Yes.
So what I was saying is that if you're volatile, that is going to repel people. And you're saying if people are not repelled, it will become volatile. So this can possibly be sort of a negative feedback rate limiting loop of adoption. But of course, a counterbalance to that is if a lot of that volatility is in the upward direction, then that is going to drive interest as an investment and people are going to adopt. But ultimately, they have to exit the system unless they can spend cryptocurrency directly. And right Absolutely. Now, in my daily life, there are not a lot of opportunities to directly spend cryptocurrency to meet your daily needs.
And not as many as I'd like, for sure.
Yeah, and that is a piece of the puzzle that absolutely needs to be solved, because a lot of these cryptocurrencies were designed as a store of value, which is great and it's important and it protects you from, you know, government thieves who steal from your savings by printing money. They steal from every dollar denominated account that exists by printing money. But a store of value is different than a means of exchange. They need different features. And something can serve as both, but it needs to have both sets of features. So I've seen a lot of movement from the cryptocurrency movement in general about developing this being a store of value, but the adaption and penetration and the feature set as a means of exchange have been sort of left behind. Now, I don't want to say anything that sounds foolish here, because I'm not on the cutting edge of this stuff. I'm not paying attention to the latest releases. But every time I've paid for something with cryptocurrency or accepted a cryptocurrency transfer in payment for something, it can take 5 to 15 minutes. Well, imagine if cash had that limitation. Imagine if your credit card had that limitation. Imagine the line at the grocery store. Imagine explaining to your little sweet old grandma that she has to wait 15 minutes to pay for her groceries. That's not going to fly too well, is it? So at some point, cryptocurrency communities are going to have to focus on the needs of the people that they consider, well, normies. You know,
Absolutely.
These little practical things that may not have been considered.
Yeah, you're speaking my language. Do you know the story of Bitcoin Cash and the hijacking Bitcoin and all that? How big up are you on the history of cryptocurrency? You know, because this is what the Bitcoin Cash community is all about, that Bitcoin was started to be a medium of exchange, right? And it was instantly transferable and it gained tons of adoption. And then there was a load of like censorship and shady shit that happened, which rebranded everything to this digital gold store of value. And then everybody was convinced that cryptocurrency was about investing. And now it's about pulling it back, that people realize, no, if you can't spend it anywhere, kind of what good, you know, it's cryptocurrency. There's a reason that's called crypto. Yeah.
You have to buy something else like dollars with it and then spend the dollars.
Yes.
And that obviously is a weakness in the system. And that is not something that you can merely design around technically, because you can design a system that is super good for fast cash payments, but that's only one part of the solution. You have to get people to adopt it. In general, anytime you want to solve a problem, any solution has two parts. Here's what people need to do, and here's how we're going to get them to do it. And what I've seen of the crypto wars, and you know, I'm not drilled down on the detailed history, but I see a lot of people yelling at each other on Twitter. is like the part two of their plans of how are we going to get people to do this seems to be yell at people a lot, you know, and tell them over and over again, this is the wave of the future. Well, that's kind of like me telling people, I'm a great writer. You should buy my book. That's not trust building. You need to show people things. So what cryptocurrency communities are going to have to do is they're going to have to build at first isolated cases, but eventually more widespread ones of this actually working for something that people actually want to do. It can't just hang around being a way for bodybuilders to buy steroids forever.
Yes, absolutely.
Or so I've heard.
No personal experience implied.
No
implied.
Personal experience at all.
but yeah, exactly. This is absolutely, you know, right up the BCH community's alley. And the tough part has been, which kind of circles back to what we were talking about before, it's very hard to build trust when you're being just drowned out by this huge sea of sort of misinformation and you know, canceling and all this kind of stuff, and when all the money is initially going in the other direction. Now that's not gonna last forever, and it hasn't, you know. Crypto is always changing, right? But if you're fighting with less resources, you have to have a more efficient strategy, a better way of breaking through the noise. And that's why I've been so keen to hear your yeah. thoughts on
except
that.
Except you're not fighting. You're yes, not well, fighting. Wrong yes. paradigm. You're building.
Building. Yes.
You're
yes,
building. No. You're building. You need resources to build, but you don't need to defeat anyone to build. You just have
to. You need to defeat all the cognitive dissonance yeah. of everyone yeah. who doesn't agree with you yet. No, I like it. It's good. It's yeah. you're right. The world is yeah. the world is a positive sum yeah. game, right?
You do not need the Bitcoin, the BTC community's permission to build something. You do yes, not absolutely. Need them to be convinced in order to build something. You do not need to defeat them in order to build something. You can just build it. And yes. if you need more money to build it, you don't need to get it from them.
Yes. Absolutely.
And if you need more manpower to build it, you don't need to get it from them. So this argument is a very natural argument to have, but it all rests on this very human fallacy of the zero-sum game. There are very few zero-sum games in nature, and this is not one of them.
Yes, absolutely. People get their yeah. get their pride, yeah. they get their emotions the, in the there, money, they get invested in it.
Yeah, the money ecosystem is so vast, and cryptocurrency's current penetration is so small that arguing about whether we should use Bitcoin or Bitcoin Cash is like starting out on a road trip from Los Angeles to New York and having a screaming argument in the first 10 miles over which of two adjacent parking spaces we are going to park in at the end of this trip.
Yes. Yes,
build,
it's missing the bigger picture.
Grow. And then eventually, when there is some kind of mass adoption, there is some kind of saturation, then the market will decide which of many, many cryptocurrencies is better for its needs. And it may end up being the kind of thing that I predict in Theft of Fire, where the answer is a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of this over here. And that's fine, too.
Can I hop in for just a moment?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think that I agree with, like, we need to hold people in contempt for certain things. And I think that there are some people in the BTC crowd specifically that these, and I'm going to use the word fighting. I understand the building paradigm thing, yes. But I think fighting and highlighting the arrogance is important because of situations like the trucker protest in Canada. You know, people's bank accounts were frozen and there was people on the ground there like, oh, we should get them to use BTC Bitcoin. But of course, like the user experience there is not great, right? The 10-minute waits, the fees, and then people go, well, what about Lightning Network? Well, then you have ruined your censorship resistance principle, like your property of why this is important in this context. So I think, like, yeah, those people should be, we should hold them in contempt and we should fight them because it's actively making people who need this technology, it's actively making their lives worse because they don't know better.
Well, I can neither argue with you nor agree with you because I don't think that I am well enough informed. You know, this means figuring out my own opinion rather than taking anybody's word for it. I don't think I have had enough exposure to the pros and cons of all these individual cryptocurrencies to make an informed decision about whether someone is sabotaging adaption or whether they're just building in a different direction. So I can't really engage with what you said, but I do think that in general, I'm more in favor of letting markets decide than trying to defeat opposing companies. So if you have a product that you want people to adapt, negative advertising doesn't really work.
Yeah, and agreed.
Maybe if we assume that what you say is true and Bitcoin has a lot of fees and a large wait time, and this is going to be something that people care about, maybe the thing to do is to let them experience that.
Well, that's what, and yeah, that's what
come
happening.
In as an alternative.
Yeah, I've said on the show like probably 4 or 5 times now that I think the best promotion for Bitcoin Cash is people using Bitcoin and then Bitcoin Cash because the user experience feels like one day.
Because ultimately, we don't get to decide what the best user experience is. We don't get to decide what the best user experience is. Users decide what is important to them. And ultimately, you always try to project what the customer wants and develop that thing. But the only way that you're going to ultimately get vindicated or get feedback is people using things or not using things, liking things or not liking things. So you have what you believe is a better experience in this product that you are promoting. And ultimately, the market is going to decide whether that's more important to the customer or not. So, you know, maybe the goal is to have people, okay, you know, I'm using Bitcoin as a store of value, but when I want to spend it, instead of transferring it to instead of selling it for dollars, I'm going to sell it for this other cryptocurrency that's easy to spend. You know, maybe they end up as the savings account and you end up as the checking account. All of these things are possibilities. So I'm not saying that this argument you're having is necessarily wrong, because I don't know enough to say that. But I'm suggesting some alternate possibilities that might pan out in the future. And I wrote science fiction drawing from my experience that you almost never really see one competitor dominating the market forever unless they're being propped up by a government.
Yes, yes. Although I don't know. I think we might see that change. You know, maybe not as things go interplanetary, because there might be logistical breakdown there. But it's certainly a broad suggestion across the cryptocurrency industry that we would see a sort of Pareto distribution, because cryptocurrencies, unlike fiat currencies, aren't limited by politics. They can be neutrally adopted everywhere, and unlike precious metals or other things, they're not logistically limited by space, you know. So I feel like maybe in 30 years it's quite likely that we'll have one cryptocurrency, which is the vast majority of you know, trade, and then there'll of course be plenty of other experimentation, but network effect is so powerful, like you said, whoever can get out of that escape velocity of the chicken and egg thing and can sustain it with the engineering to back it up will just run away with it. Probably.
Well, almost anything is possible. I mean, we know precious metals are doomed.
Okay.
When we leave the gravity well, precious metals as a store of value are doomed. And I gave one little shout out in Theft of Fire to that. There's one moment where he's talking about loading a magazine into a rifle, and he mentions that the standard bullet is just a lump of gold.
Yes.
Because when you start mining asteroids, gold is a reasonable material to make bullets out of.
Absolutely.
So when you get out, and I'm going to get on my asteroid mining soapbox for just a minute here.
Go ahead.
Because I think asteroid mining, and I'm going to blaspheme here, I think asteroid mining is probably more important than cryptocurrency. And the reason for this is that we live in a gravity well, and a gravity well is a pit. And when you have a pit, heavy things tend to end up at the bottom. They displace lighter things and they sink to the bottom. So a lot of the interesting substances that we need for building a lot of our cool high-tech civilizational tricks, they're all at the core of the Earth. And we are scratching out the little tiny bits that haven't sunk to the bottom. And when you get out into the solar system and there are all these pieces of shattered debris that don't have a deep gravity well, then all of a sudden, all these things that are very rare on Earth are very easy to extract and throw back at a Martian orbit, where you can have a nice gravity environment to manufacture things in, which has a very low escape velocity, so you can ship them elsewhere very easily. And now you start to discover just how many of your technological processes are bottlenecked by the scarcity of heavy elements. You know, what happens when really, really good steel becomes super cheap? What happens when all your rare earth elements, which is literally what they're called, it's a whole sequence in the periodic table, rare earth elements, what happens when they're not rare and they're not earth? All of a sudden, you can do a lot of things cheaply that you couldn't do before. You know, all of a sudden, your batteries aren't so expensive. You know, all of a sudden, your circuitry isn't so expensive. You know, you revolutionize the battery industry. You revolutionize the semiconductor industry. You revolutionize all sorts of little branches of engineering that we're not drilled down on, but boy, do they make a difference in our lives. So this is big, important stuff. When we get to a stage when there is no such thing as a precious metal or a precious element, then you see a second industrial revolution, especially when you get your head out of your ass and start making nuclear plants.
Absolutely.
So absolutely. I think cryptocurrency is an important piece of that, because then when you have this huge economic boom, you want money that can move around and be invested very easily. You want a nice, solid, useful money technology. But ultimately, these other things are going to drive the second industrial revolution. And that's what's going to help us colonize the entire solar system, become a multiplanetary species, and start to reach toward the stars.
Absolutely. And on that note, we are going to be coming up to the end of our time here soon. But I had one question that I had to ask you about the book. I really enjoyed reading because there's a number of like little references in there. You mentioned George R. R. Martin before in Game of Thrones. There's a line where he's getting called out for that in so many words, right? Yes, there's a bit of references to Elon Musk in there as well. And there's various other things that if you're a perceptive reader or you're got the right context, you'll pick up on. I'm sure there's probably quite a number of other ones that I didn't get, but there was two that I think I caught that I wanted to fact check with you. Yes. The first one was when they get the, I guess I don't want to spoil too much of the plot, but one of them is Fallout, right? The guy with the thumb. I actually have never played Fallout, but they have the painting on the ship of the guy with the thumb. Is that Fallout?
Oh, no, that is actually a rude gesture.
No, that's what they do. That's the what they repaint afterwards.
Yeah, but that's what they, that, they. Oh, no. Tough Voyaging.
Yes.
Is actually another reference to one of George R. R. Martin's earlier works.
All right. Okay.
A book called Tough Voyaging, which I highly recommend.
All right. Okay. It's, in the description of the,
it's quite entertaining. It's actually very socialist coded. So you have to get past that, but it's still a good story.
Okay. All right. Well, that's I had that one wrong, but when it's written of the graphic, it was like sounded like that giant guy with the thumb. I don't even know what that is, but that's a
Fallout. Yeah. That some of that Fallout logo stuff. I hadn't really thought to put a Fallout reference in because a lot of these references are to science fiction works that inspired and excited me as a child.
Yes.
And, you know, I did take some time to poke fun at George Martin, but a lot of the references are a little more reverent to some stuff that I really, really liked. You know, like the three asteroid miners, Hamilton, Schaefer, and Wu. And some of your older science fiction fans will recognize that. So what was the other one?
The other one was Lena, she's holding the conch shell, right? The seashell. It's Lord of the Flies. Is that William Golding?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
I got Lord that of the one. Flies. All right. Okay. I'm very glad I got at least one of those right. Okay. Perfect.
Yeah.
I read that and I thought it's got to be Lord of the Flies, but I had to double check with you.
Yeah, those have been great fun because it's great fun to see people spot those, and not all of them have been spotted yet. There are still Easter eggs that have not been publicly found. So
there you go. I guess that's
and
motivation.
Hopefully more people will get a chance to search for those as we complete the audiobook, which I am recording right now. It is full cast, and we've still got a couple more days on our Kickstarter, but we went ahead and we took the risk of starting recording early, and that paid off because we've triple funded and are closing in on quadruple funding, so it's been very popular. But this is going to be a full cast, separate actors for each of the major characters version, and I'm personally directing it, and to a very high standard of quality. I mean, I'm Kubricking the shit out of this. We're sometimes doing 10, 12 takes per line just to get all the little nuances right. So if there are people out there whose preferred format is audiobook, you have something special coming very soon, and we're very excited about it.
Amazing. Okay, we have this last segment that we always have on the show every week, which is called Message to the Community, which is where I just let the guests say, obviously, this is the Bitcoin Cash podcast. A lot of the Bitcoin Cash community listens to this, and we've already talked about, you know, various perspectives or things that they could have. But if you could just say one thing, anything, whether it's an advice, a message, not a plug, I'll give you another chance to wrap those up in a second, but any sort of wisdom or story for the community, what would it be?
In the long run, engineering wins technological arguments, and it wins them by appealing to a market. So I understand the point your colleague here made about needing to refute misinformation. And yes, that is important. But ultimately, you win by building that which appeals to the customer and by providing it to the customer. And if you see the people who you are attempting to proselytize to as customers rather than as people who need to be religiously converted, then you start to refocus on what their needs are and listening to them. And that is the way to eventually come out ahead.
Yeah, brilliant. Spot on. I think that is actually what people need to hear. And certainly, yeah, very, very on theme with, I think, the direction things are trending in. So that's really great. I think we're moving in the right direction. Okay, we've got our supporter appreciation. Just like you, I have some religiously devoted fans that occasionally send in BCH donations. Thank you very much to them. Thank you to our patrons, Ricky and HP. Thank you to our sponsor, General Protocols. Check it out at bchbull.com. Solution to the volatility problem you were mentioning. And our FundMe is at fundme.cash. Majamalu Marcelo, 2024.bcharg.com. Molecular and Erdogan Talk. You can also get your name on this list by donating 0.5 BCH. Start guide FAQs and links are at bitcoincashpodcast.com. If you're new to the show, you can check out episode 85 and try Celine Wallet at celine.cash. Final shout outs, and where can people find more of you? Twitter, Substack, anywhere else that you should have a look? Go buy
Twitter, Substack. The book's on Amazon. The audiobook is on Kickstarter, and you can pre-order it cheap. And we have lots of other exciting prizes for people who wish to be patrons of the arts.
TapSwap, you've got the NFTs there that you can pick up as well if they want to get it in BCH.
Yes, my website is devinerickson.com if people want to read a 3-chapter preview of the first novel and see if it is to their tastes. And I also have a Substack, which can be found by searching for Devin Erickson on Substack. And that is more political and social commentary and nonfiction writing for people who enjoy that.
Brilliant. And from my own interests, what's the timeline looking like on Orbital Space Book 2? You said you're about halfway through?
Yes. That's paused right now to record the audiobook, which we're almost finished with. And we have been having some additional challenges with the wife having stage 4 cancer. So, not to be too depressive. There's some hope for the treatment there. We're not out of this fight, but that is demanding a certain amount of my time. So I had hoped to release on November 11th again, like I did last year. It's probably going to slip to the beginning of next year, but it is in process. All the major structure is in place. I just need to get the word by word, sentence by sentence, writing completely finished. We're about halfway. I'll get there.
Okay. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. Jed, any final shout outs for the show?
This one, Evan, I had not really heard of any of your work. I had seen Bitcoin Cash Autist talk about you a couple times, but I have been so busy and I have not read in a long time, aside from hijacking Bitcoin.
Everybody's got their own stuff.
Yeah.
I'll get you eventually.
Oh yeah, no, you got me. You're convinced. I'm gonna get a copy of the book for sure.
Well, I hope you enjoy.
Thank you.
Amazing. And my shout out, yeah, goes to Bitcoin Cash Ortis for lining this up. You know, firstly, just a mega fan of your work and of my work too, I think. And that's what brings communities together. And also,
thanks, we've had, you've been awesome.
Absolute legend. And we've had some comments from listeners as well on the show in the past. Like I mentioned, the listener survey at the start, that they would, some listeners say, look, you keep having these Bitcoin Cash guests on, let's hear from someone different. Let's hear from somebody, you know, with more of an outside perspective, who maybe isn't as deep in the weeds or can have a fresh take on things. And I think we really got that from this episode. So it's been amazing in that sense. And thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been great fun.
I'm already looking forward to that book too. So I'll be spotting more of the references as well too. I'm only one out of two. That's annoying me now. So I'm gonna have to try and dig up.
Well, you have to read more science fiction.
Well, yeah, clearly I do. Exactly. Exactly. I'm lacking the background context.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Until next time.